Hello, welcome to Behind the Headlines podcast with me, John Crowley.
And me, Hannah Storm. In these podcasts, we'll be talking to journalists, many of them household names, about the stories they've covered and the experiences that have impacted them, how they try to make sense of it all, and how our industry is adapting to the realisation that we need to protect our storytellers. John and I are both directors of Headlines Network and long-time journalists.
Journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in. But, as we're frequently told, never become the story, which, as we'll hear, can often be hard.
For this episode, we've been speaking with Dr. Sian Williams, best known as a journalist and news presenter. But a few months ago, Sian passed her doctorate in counselling psychology. She began by telling us about what she'd learned about her own resilience during a career which has seen her cover some of the biggest stories in the past three decades.
Resilience levels are never really set at one point. They go up and down, depending, I think, on what we're doing, our energy reserves. There's been many times when I haven't felt resilient at all, actually, many times. Not just at work, not just as a journalist, but personally as well, when I've encountered stuff in my own life that's been really testing. And I think what you have to do is to just turn inside and notice what it is that's going on with you and look at it openly and honestly and think, what do I do here? You know, I've got a number of options. There's a choice point for me. I can either be hooked up by this stuff. I can either be really fused by it or in it, whether it's anxiety or a low mood or those sort of catastrophizing, ruminating thoughts that you can get caught up in, or I can kind of unhook myself and move towards something else which might be more positive and might help me in this instance. And so I guess the way I see resilience is not bouncing back, or I think it's more a consideration of where you are at any given point and thinking to yourself, what can I do actively now that will help me in this instant? And I think sometimes that can vary. I did a program called The Science of Resilience, and it was interesting because one of the experts I spoke to said, typically they've divided people up into dandelions and orchids, and dandelions are thought to be these things that can grow anywhere and they're very strong and they can cope with anything that's thrown at them, you know, and they poke up between the cracks in the pavements. And the orchids are sort of slightly fragile, and if you don't get the right conditions they might wither and die, and you know, which one are you? And I thought, I'm probably a bit more of an orchid because I'm very sensitive. And actually he identified me as that as well. But he said the thing about being an orchid is that, or at least being more sensitive, is that you're much more highly attuned to your own emotional health. Now, that can be a really good thing if you notice there's stuff going on here and I think I need to do something about it. It's less good if there's stuff going on and you are caught up in it and you can't see the way out. But I think it's good to be sensitive. I think being sensitive helps with your levels of resilience because you can help yourself and you can notice it in other people as well.
I just want to pick up on that notion of the orchid and the dandelion, because I think as journalists, a lot of the time we're conditioned, or there's this assumption we're going to be resilient. And generally we are resilient, aren't we? But I think there's also, when you mentioned about orchids, I thought about, you know, how empathy lies at the heart of journalism. So how do you kind of make sure that you're empathetic, the stories you cover, with the people you work with, and yet you also kind of look after yourself as well?
Well, I think you're right. I think the best journalists are the ones who are most empathic, who are the most sensitive, who can pick up on other people's distress. I mean, that's how you are able to amplify other people's voices. They need to be able to trust in you to look directly in your eyes and think, is this somebody I can share my vulnerability with? If you are that person, it's a huge responsibility to hold that story and to tell that story well and with respect. I think sometimes that can obviously affect you a lot more than others. I think you keep having to remind yourself that you are dealing with highly vulnerable people. This is what got me into the work of psychology in the first place, actually, from the very beginning in 1989, you know, with the Hillsborough disaster, thinking, I'm speaking to people who are grief-stricken. How much do they know about what they're telling me? if they were to look back on this interview, would they be okay about it? Would I be okay about it? And so I think there's always a dance between the journalist and the person you are interviewing, making sure that you're not going too far into their own vulnerability, but allowing them to have the voice that's needed to tell their story and to say what's going on in the world in a way that other people can relate to. And so I do think you need a lot of compassion and a lot of empathy to be able to do that well. Obviously, what that also means is that stories can perhaps sometimes affect you adversely, and then you may feel guilt about being affected adversely because you may be thinking, well, what have I got to feel guilty about? What have I got to feel sad about or frustrated about, when actually it's the person I'm talking to who's in the midst of all this? You're bearing witness, and I think there is a real protective force among journalists, and I know this because of the research I've done in journalists, and I know, Hannah, you've done research with journalists too. The act of bearing witness to the suffering of others is protective for the journalist. So it enables a journalist to say to themselves, actually, I am doing something that I know is important here. And that sometimes lessens that feeling of guilt you get for being parachuted into a story, getting people's really, really terrible real life issues of what's going on with them, putting it out to the world and then going home to your comfortable, safe life.
You and I have spoken quite a lot about this idea of this emotional flak jacket, haven't we? I mean, we journalists in war zones, we wear a flak jacket, a bulletproof vest. This idea of, you know, this kind of idea of bearing witness, I think, is another piece of protective equipment in some ways for us, as you said. But I want to kind of, when we've worked in the past together, you've spoken to us about one particular story when you were covering the earthquake in Pakistan, and about a moment where it wasn't that you were specifically speaking with the people and telling their stories, but something happened while you were on air that impacted you. Are you able to kind of share a bit more around that experience?
Yeah, I guess, and again, this isn't something that drew me to wanting to understand the process of the brain in trauma, in order to try to help in some way, I guess. But I was presenting the 1 o'clock news on the BBC, and I was in the heart of Kashmir just after the earthquake struck in 2006. And we were among the first to get to the epicenter of the earthquake. And so the infrastructure was appalling. People didn't have any shelter. There was rubble everywhere. There was no sanitation. There was no food. And people were in absolutely desperate straits. And I was broadcasting live for the 1 o'clock news. And as I was broadcasting, I could hear some scuffles, things going on behind me. I didn't turn around because I was facing the camera and I needed to continue delivering the news. But at the end of the bulletin, I turned round and I saw two brothers who were going through the rubble, and they'd found their mother who died under the rubble, and they were wailing. And the noises I was hearing, and perhaps what the viewers were seeing, were these three brothers digging through the rubble with their bare hands and eventually finding their dead mother and keening with grief over the body. And I felt a profound sense of responsibility. It still affects me now just thinking about it, because I thought, what was my responsibility to them that I should have given them the dignity of privacy in that moment? I didn't know it was happening, but it made me really question, how close do we need to be to grief, to suffering, in order for people to really know what's going on? I guess that drew me to thinking about an understanding of grief and trauma, and also its impact on journalists. I came back then and I trained to study as a trauma assessor. So I was assessing a trauma in other people, in my colleagues at the BBC at that time, so that I could help identify anybody who might be struggling with acute stress or PTSD. And then from that, I did a master's in psychology and went on to do a doctorate. But I think that was one of the defining moments, definitely.
Sean, thank you for sharing that story. Returning to such memories, obviously, you know, is traumatic. And you've just spoken there. Can you draw a thread between those experiences with your work? Did that spark your interest in mental health? Because as you say, you are now a counselling psychologist, to give your full title. You're now Dr. Sean Williams, aren't you?
Yeah. And you know what? And I just want to reflect, John, as well, that I didn't pay attention to my own feelings of guilt and responsibility and horror with that moment in Pakistan for a long time, actually. So I trained as a trauma assessor, even as I hadn't properly processed it myself, because it felt too self-indulgent to acknowledge it to myself, if that makes sense. Looking back, all these incidents are the ones that led me here, I guess. So everything, every person I've sat in front of and had the privilege of interviewing, every news event I've seen, every encounter I've ever had with a big story, I think has bit by bit by bit taken me towards this new understanding of the brain and how we can help ourselves and how we can best help others. So, yeah, I think it was various news events that I'd been working on, training as the trauma assessor, speaking to fellow journalists about their own difficulties in the field, how much they love the job, how important it was to them to do the bearing witness that we've talked about, but also how it might have affected them professionally and personally. Then did a master's in psychology to understand what's going on in the brain at any given moment. You know, what's happening neurologically under threat? How does the brain process threat? And then did a thesis I did some research with journalists responding to difficult events. Then I started a doctorate. I got cancer along the way, so I wrote a book about how people process trauma and adversity and difficulty. And I became interested in how people manage really difficult times and how they go through adversity and who they are on the other side. And I guess what they've learned along the way, how they cope and whether there are any commonalities in that coping mechanism. And then I worked in the NHS during the study for the doctorate, worked with families with acute trauma in Kent, where I live, and worked with students in King's College in London, many of whom had come to the counselling service I was in, with all sorts of difficulties, from sort of anxiety and depression to suicidality to self-harm to disordered eating. So it was a very rich and varied training where I got to speak to, where I was, again, I was privileged to be invited into people's lives, to be alongside them, trying to work out what was going on for them in the hope that we might find some sort of better place for them to be in.
There's so much that you've mentioned there. There are so many different threads to your experience. And it's, you know, this idea of walking alongside people is something that really has struck me from every conversation you and I have had together. I just want to unpick a little bit, if possible, this kind of idea of journalists and journalism and mental health. So John and I both became interested in the conversation because of our own personal experiences, a little bit like what you mentioned, the personal experiences we had, the places we'd been, the stories we'd covered, and decided that we wanted to become involved in this. So the research that you did in terms of how journalists respond to trauma, can you talk to us a little bit about what you discovered about journalists in that, through that research?
So the research I was doing was with journalists, some of whom had worked on the ground, so they'd been in disaster zones and conflict areas, some of whom had worked in the office and hadn't actually been out to do any on the ground stuff, but were still experiencing some form of discomfort. And I used a post-traumatic stress disorder scale to measure their levels of distress over their worst incident. So if they were to imagine what their worst incident was, or they remembered what their worst incident was, what was their response to it now? And it was about whether that past incident was still playing into their present, whether they were still feeling it in their present. So if you imagine, for example, somebody's walking down the street and a car backfires, and instantly the reporter or the camera person or whoever is parachuted back to a conflict zone. That is a traumatic response to a past event. What I was trying to get to in this research is, are they still holding those difficult feelings? Are they still responding in a kind of fight, flight, freeze way, even though that event is in the past? And even though a lot of the people I was speaking to were in disaster and conflict zones, there were also people who were watching. Syria at that point was very much in the news, and there were lots of images of children whose skin had been flayed by chemical weapons. So some people were sitting in front of a computer, and hour after hour after hour, they were trying to process these extraordinarily traumatic images, some of which, most of which, would never see the light of day, would never be put on television because they just were so gruesome and horrific. But some of these news crew were taking them home, were thinking of them. There was one of my participants who said it felt like she was constantly living in a Tarantino movie. And that one day she went out and she was in the car with her boyfriend, and they were just going out for a lunchtime drink. And something happened. It was a noise, or it was a smell, or she couldn't even identify what it was. And instantly her mind was taken back to the image of a burnt out car that she had seen a few days previously. Now, that is the past playing into the present. And what I wanted to know was, how many people are still experiencing that kind of stuff if they have looked at, been in difficult environments? And then what do they do with it? And who out of those people come out having coped and having recovered well? And if they have recovered well, what has helped them to recover well? And again, it's about seeing the commonalities. What has worked to get you in a better place? If you have been in that place, what gets you to a different place? And in the end, what the research suggested was that there are common threads with people who recover well after trauma, and that is being able to reflect on it with somebody who feels safe to reflect on it with. Often that's one of your peers, that might be somebody that you're working with rather than your family. It's quite hard sometimes to revisit this stuff on your family when, if they have no access to it, if there's no understanding of it, to reflect on it, to have support at work, to feel like management isn't sort of lacking or hostile, but to actually feel that you get proper feedback, that people recognise you and value you for what you're doing. So there are a whole host of different things that they felt had really led to a better understanding of themselves and that they could recover well. So when these incidents do occur, when suddenly that flash does come into your brain, which it may still do, that you are able to go, I know what this is. I know what this is, and I'm not in danger, and I'm going to put it there, and I'm going to connect with the stuff that brings me back to a more stable sense of self.
And I know where I am, presumably, as
and
well.
And I know where I am, yeah.
Because I think, go on.
No, I know where I am. So I'm not back there. I'm here and I'm safe. And it's that feeling of safety and being able to connect to that feeling of safety. What that does to the brain is it turns the brain from that threat state where you're doing the fight, flight, freeze, or submit is another one. And you're going into a, okay, and it's a different part of the brain clicks into gear. It's the prefrontal cortex. It's the bit that's responsible for the executive functions of the brain, the planning, the contextualizing, the memory. And that enables you to go, okay, I'm all right. Everything's okay. That was in the past. We can put it in a past. This is the present and I'm safe.
I'm very struck by what you say there about this idea that those people who seemed to cope better, perhaps coped more because of the community and the sense of community, the people they were able to connect with. Our journalism community were very sociable. We tend to, you know, it's great to have the peer support. However, I think both you and I have probably seen over the past couple of decades a change from that kind of quite macho behaviour and that quite macho culture where mental health is not really spoken openly about, and a change over the past few years. Is that something that you've seen as well?
Yeah, I have seen a change. I've certainly seen an openness when it comes to discussing these sorts of things. That there was, when I first started talking about it 15 years ago now, I remember one journalist, a senior journalist, came up to me and said, stop talking about post-traumatic stress disorder and journalists because it just encourages people to think they have it and to take time off sick. And it's the job of the journalist to do it. And actually, you know what? believe it or not, last week I still had somebody coming to me saying that they were distressed over what was happening with the current conflict in Ukraine, and that they had been told by someone who was more senior to them that it's what we do, it's journalists, just get on with it. So I think it's still there. I think it's no longer as prevalent as it used to be, certainly 15, 20 years ago, or even 35 years ago when I started. But I do think there's a way to go. There is a way to go for leaders in media to acknowledge that we need to protect our minds in the same way as we protect our bodies when we're dealing with difficult news events. And when we're dealing with conflict, it comes to the fore. But this happens 365 days of the year. You know, we've just come out of a pandemic where people have spent 2 years in a state of threat and danger, and they're pretty much exhausted. And now they're going in to deal with what's happening in Ukraine. We've got to help them with their mental, emotional resources to enable them to do the job well. We've got to protect the storytellers, because otherwise, how are we going to know what the story is?
We can't ignore Ukraine, Sian. We're recording this after the recent invasion of the country by Russia. You've written about managing anxiety during the Ukraine crisis, how small things can help in big moments. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah. And again, it's hard, isn't it, for us to think of ourselves when we see what's going on elsewhere. And I think if we are to remain compassionate and to be able to do something, then we need to make sure that we are resilient enough to be in a position to do it. So we're noticing a sort of an outbreak of goodwill and community and volunteering and donating that's happening in the UK for people in Ukraine. And I think that has a lot to do with the initial feeling was a complete lack of control and huge uncertainty and fear and anxiety. And I think once you notice that, you notice those thoughts and emotions and sensations that are coming with that rage and helplessness and impotence, and you kind of name it and you know why it's there, and you can then choose what to do with it. And I think what people are seeing now is that they have something in them which can help in whatever small way. I think that makes an enormous difference to how we feel about managing the emotions that come with what we're seeing and doing. A lot of it we don't feel we can get involved in. It's you know, it's happening a couple of hours flight away from us, and as much as we'd like to, there's a feeling of what can I do, what can I do? And then realizing, standing back and saying, well, it's no good me being in this feeling of frozen impotence. I notice it. I know why it's there. I know that I'm fearful. But actually, is there something I can do, however small? Yes, there is. I can donate. Me and about 5,200 people are going to be walking a marathon to raise funds for a couple of local Ukrainian charities. You know, it's not much, but it's something. And I think it's the doing something which makes people feel that they can attend to this more easily rather than look away. The temptation sometimes is to just turn it off and look away. And I think many people think, I do need to look at it. I need to, going back to the bearing witness, I do need to bear witness to this horror. I can't just turn it off, not look at it. I have to face it because it's there. But in facing it, and in seeing it, I also think, well, what little can I do? What can I do in order to help in my small way? And that helps with our own levels of resilience. And that means that we're better able to cope with what's going on around us. We're better able to talk about it with our own children, which again is quite a difficult conversation because you're managing their uncertainty as well as your own. You know, the big grown-up conversation sometimes to be had with teenagers about, you know, this is the world. I can't tell you what's going to happen. And that's uncomfortable to sit with, but that's what life is. It's sitting uncomfortably sometimes with uncertainty.
In our previous episode, our first episode, we spoke to Lindsay Hilsum from Channel 4 and Lise Doucette from the BBC about the risk that they're taking. They're out in Ukraine now. And you spoke about this earlier, Sean, about being storytellers and kind of making kind of big decisions around risk. What we've also seen as well, Hannah and I, is something of a sea change in journalists kind of acknowledging those decisions and being asked them live on air, broadcast journalists, about the personal and professional of putting your life in danger, where they've spoken about their mental health. And perhaps that's something we may not have seen broadcast journalists talking about a few years ago. And at Behind the Headlines, we're very much interested in trying to give an insight into kind of what goes on behind the scenes. Have you noticed that change as well, where journalists live on air are a lot more transparent and open about their feelings, which may feel slightly odd initially to do?
Yeah, but I think it's a very difficult line, John. I think there is a tension there because journalists don't like being the story, because they're not the story. They're there to broadcast the story, to witness the story, and to bring the story to others. And I think if you get too involved in the story, then you can't provide the slight distance that the viewer and listener needs.
That objectivity.
Yeah, in order to fully understand that story. I think while we need to hear the humanity of a journalist, and we need to hear that sensitivity and empathy that the journalist brings to the story, and yes, how it affects them. I think most journalists who will be reporting from Ukraine, even if they are reflecting on their own difficulties in that story, will always say, but I have the opportunity to get out. I have the opportunity to go home. And their acknowledgement, they're in a very different position to the people that they're reporting about.
And it's back to that choice and agency that we were talking about before as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Because there is a choice. There is the journalists do have a choice to be there or not. If they want to come out, they can come out. Well, mainly they can come out unless they're under siege. They do put themselves in huge amounts of risk and danger in order to bring us the news. And we're really appreciative. And I think sometimes it is important to hear how it is impacting on them, because you can't be a dispassionate observer. And I think there is a difference between that dispassionate observance and objectivity. Being too dispassionate might seem like that old kind of pathé expert voice. And I think there needs to be some feeling of understanding. And I think that feeling of understanding comes through sometimes the journalist's more personal approach to it. But I think it is always going to be quite a tricky, delicate balance between how much of you you put in, because if you put too much of you in it, then it's going to obscure the voices that you're there to broadcast.
You brought some of your own personal experiences, and we've talked there about that balance, but I wanted to kind of move, if it's okay, a bit more to your personal experiences. Several years ago, you wrote a best-selling book, Rise, Surviving and Thriving After Trauma. Can you tell us a little bit about how your personal experiences of a cancer diagnosis, you lost your mum, you had a difficult birth of one of your children, how have those experiences helped you channel that ability to thrive?
I don't think they felt like they helped at the time. They were very unwelcome visitors, all of them. And at the time, I thought I wouldn't survive the birth of my son, for example. I was very lucky to survive. There was a moment when I had a massive hemorrhage after he was born, and there was a moment when I could feel, actually, I felt quite peaceful. But I lost 4 pints of blood very, very quickly, and it turned into an emergency quite quickly, and I was quite calm actually. And when I was on the stretcher, you know, I remember I was drifting in and out of consciousness, but I remember being stretchered out of the hospital room and looking back at my husband and... Sorry.
Take your time, it's okay.
Isn't it funny how these things can still scratch at us, can't they? Looking back at my husband and just saying, you know, look after him. because he'd been, my son had just been born blue and flat, and he'd been, took time to come round. And then we were very lucky, very lucky. He'd been deprived of oxygen, but he survived. He fitted for the first 4 years of his life, but he's a fantastic young man now. And we're both, gosh, we're lucky. But I do remember that feeling of being quite calm, being wheeled out, thinking, he's in good hands. It's going to be okay. So I would not invite those moments in. But I think, what have I learned from them? Oof, and having cancer too, I think what you learn is you do come through. And you do come through with a greater sense of understanding of, you know, I can acknowledge now that these things touch me very deeply, and that there were moments when it was very much on a knife edge whether I would be here or not be here. And as well as a sort of profound sense of gratitude, I also think I did learn in those moments. I learned about how to recover. I learned about taking things slowly. I learned about not beating yourself up for not recovering faster than you'd like. I tend to be very going at one pace, which is fast. And then I go fast and then I just can stop and then collapse, which is not very good. And I think I was recognising that wasn't a healthy way to live. And therefore, when I used to, and actually this happened both after the birth of my son and also during the cancer, when I heard my voice, my self-critical voice, which can be really loud, saying, you're not recovering fast enough, you know, I kind of recognised it and go, well, no, thanks very much for reminding me of that. I'm going to just pop you there and I'm going to try to bring, which felt really counterintuitive at first. And actually this is my doctoral thesis, was on self-compassion and self-criticism, because I find that a lot of us can very easily go to self-criticism. You're not doing this, you're not this enough, or you're not that enough. But when it comes to self-compassion, it's much harder to hold. It's much harder to be nicer to ourselves. We can be very nice to other people, and we've got huge amounts of empathy and compassion and kindness, which we can show to others. But we never, sometimes we can rarely use that same voice when we're going through something. And I think it's that, how do we do that? How do we hold those feelings of self-kindness and self-compassion without somehow feeling like this is selfish and, you know, that kind of old stiff upper lip and just get on with it. But to be kind to ourselves in those moments when we are recovering, which sometimes feel a bit sticky and bumpy and messy and murky, and that's okay. I think it's also about acknowledging the ups and downs, that growth doesn't start at the bottom and go in a straight line all the way up to the top. You know, I was sick and now I'm better. It's back and forth. And we can be going in one direction, then we can stumble and we have to pick ourselves up and we have to go again. So it's about, right, well, if I know that this is going to be a bit of a sort of windy road and there are going to be stumbles along the way and things that unexpectedly trip me up, what can I put in my backpack that I know will help me cope, that I can always reach for, that I can think, ah, well, I know actually that I've got this experience that I got through, and I got through with doing this, you know, reaching for the outstretched hand when it was offered me, rather than saying, no, I can do this on my own, thanks very much. Or taking some time out to do some sort of proper breathing, or turning to decent foods in an early night rather than the fridge or the cupboard for chocolate while you're sort of trying to tamp down the emotions. You know, recognising what's going on and saying, wow, you know, that feeling that I just experienced there was because I hadn't talked about it for a long time. I think the old Sian would say, what on earth were you doing? You know, this happened 15 years ago. It would be the get a grip Sian. It's a process, but I'm trying to do the, actually, you know, that's part of a very important part of your experience. And it's not surprising that it scratches at a few of the things that you find difficult. But remember the stuff that, where you are, be grateful for where you are, and think of the stuff as well that helped get you through it.
Sian, thank you. I mean, I have to pause and say thank you. I was, I had tears in my eyes when you were talking about that. I had my own very difficult birth with a child about 6 years ago, and it does still affect us. But yes, as you say, that moment of feeling immense gratitude and feeling, as you say, with the backpack, you know, what you've got in the backpack and what resources you've now got that you can rely on. You have taught me, and many other people have helped me kind of figure out how to name things, how to feel things, how to, if I'm talking about past trauma, I can say, now I feel my hands are getting sweaty now. It's okay, I know I'm safe, but it's still my body's response. And it's incredibly valuable that you've just shared that. So thank you. I think that vulnerability, we're not so good in the past, at least we haven't been of framing that vulnerability as, you know, as talking about that vulnerability, but actually it's a strong thing to do. Yeah. Vulnerability can be strength.
Oh, I absolutely believe that a vulnerability can be strength, definitely. We need to accept our own fragility, and actually we need to tell our children that it's okay to be emotional, that it's okay to cry, that it's okay to feel anger. That's an emotion that can be really hard to sit with or to be close to, but sometimes it's valid. Sometimes it is. And I think just noticing and naming and being present with difficult emotions are incredibly important, while you're also sort of checking your own self-judgment about it and your own criticism about it. But we need to have those honest conversations about what's going on at any given moment. And yeah, fragility, vulnerability, they can absolutely, recognizing them can absolutely be a strength, because what you're saying to yourself in that moment, as soon as you name it, oh, I know what this is. Okay, hello, old friend, kind of thing. All right, why am I here? What were there any triggers or trips that brought me here? What was it that brought me here? Was it a memory? Was it a smell? Was it a, all right, well, what am I, do I feel a bit, where am I now? And what can I do in this moment now to help myself get through this moment? So yeah, I think it's an important thing to acknowledge our own vulnerabilities, definitely.
Sean, in terms of what's next for you, you were part of the launch team of the extended 60-minute evening news program on Channel 5 News. How has that extended version been received? You've actually got a segment, haven't you, within that called Mind Matters, which you present within the show around mental health. So, you know, this is obviously a subject very close to your heart.
Yeah, I'm really pleased that we were able to do that, actually, because we're the first news program to openly recognize the importance of mental health in that we're doing it regularly on a weekly basis. It's a 5 to 10 minute slot each Wednesday where we get to pause and just reflect on the things that people are living with and get to hear from their own experiences about what has helped them, and I think that helps other people. So we did, I interviewed Rory Bremner a few weeks ago on being diagnosed with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, as an adult, and how he wanted to talk about the positives of that. And he said from the very beginning, you know, I'm not here to come in to talk about how ADHD is a bad thing, because I want to talk about what's brilliant about ADHD and how I can see it as a superpower. I got so many emails after that, as did he, saying it's so refreshing for somebody to look at a mental health issue and say, actually, you know, this contributes to me being like this, which I love. And yes, it does mean occasionally that there are difficulties and obstacles, and I'm not saying that it's a cakewalk, because it absolutely isn't. But he said it's enabled him to be the creative, rather impulsive person with hyper focus, where he is constantly interested and inspired by things. And yes, his brain can jump around sometimes. And yes, sometimes he has to sort of direct that attention in one particular way. He says he has learnt a lot from his ADHD. And he says he sees his ADHD as his friend. Occasionally it can be his enemy, but more often it's his friend. Now, I think having a perspective like that, because don't forget, ADHD has the word disorder at the end. I'm not a fan of the word disorder attached to mental health and well-being, but he doesn't see it as a disorder. We've had people who are living with autism on. I used to work with a lot of people with autism and ADHD when I worked in family trauma. So neurodiversity, and also I think because of the birth of my son and various issues that are going on there, I'm very interested in neurodiversity, and we've had quite a few stories on there. But we've also had... We had a wonderful woman called Wendy Mitchell who was talking about living with dementia, where she said the gift that dementia has given her is hallucination, because she hallucinated the image of her dead father, which was hugely reassuring. So she said, even though she knew this is a hallucination, this is a result of the plaques and tangles, which is a result of my dementia, she was enormously comforted by that. So I think it's hearing different perspectives of people who you would traditionally hear something like autism, dementia, ADHD, all these sorts of different issues that we're dealing with. You may think that they come from a very negative perspective. And I think what we're doing is looking at it from a different angle. I'm hugely grateful that we're doing it.
Sian, it seems like a perfect moment to wrap up that positive aspect, that fact that you just mentioned Wendy and her gift, Rory and the superpower. It's such a great and interesting way to kind of reframe conversations that have often been shrouded in stigma and taboo. We are immensely grateful to you for giving your time to us to talk about your experiences in journalism and your work in mental health. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you both.
It's great to end there on such a positive note, talking about mental health conditions not as disorders, but as superpowers or gifts.
You know, you're right, John. And I think listening to Sian there was a real gift in of itself. There was such humanity and honesty in the way she spoke about the experiences that she'd had and those that had affected her. You know, there's something about that vulnerability that, you know, as we talked about, reframing that as strength. And it's so important that we're able to do that in journalism. And I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to create Behind the Headlines, to show the stories that journalists are impacted by, to show that they're more than robots, and to show that journalists matter. To borrow from Sian, that we need to protect our storytellers, because if we can do that, we can protect our journalism as well.
If you liked our podcast, we'd love you to leave a comment wherever you listen. Please do share it with friends, family and colleagues. And we look forward to welcoming you next time for another episode of Behind the Headlines.